classroom, it has several qualities. The women that I'm talking about, and we'll be reading some sections from, find themselves on a kind of a personal, individual quest, which often leads them away from any orthodoxies or religious communities that they've grown up in. At the same time, they're marked by a search for community. And the theme of the need to define oneself, often against whatever religion you started out with, and the search for another community or connection with other people is an important one. Spirituality, as opposed to many religious books, I think is marked, secondly, by a sort of tentative quality. These are books of searching, seeking, and they often end not completely resolved. The author does not preach that we should all necessarily accept her solution, but there's a real kind of tentative groping quality in all of them that leaves a lot of questions unanswered, I think, in contrast to many religious works. There's an emphasis in all of these women on personal experience, on feeling, on bodily experiences, and I think somewhat of a reaction against doctrine, dogma, intellectual truths, which are important and yet often seem to be the starting place. And in fact, it's a human experience that's the starting point for our experience of the sacred. The ideas, the explanations, the doctrines and dogmas should come later. And finally, I think the last quality of spirituality characterizing these works is a wish to find the sacred or spiritual dimensions of ordinary human experience, whether it's the world of, whether it's the natural landscape in Kathleen Norris's Dakota, or other people, or one's bodily experience, or whatever it is. I think these women are all reacting against some religious tradition that has said religion is over here and all this other stuff is profane, ordinary, and in some way not sacred. They're all kind of trying to overcome that dualism. I'm interested in not any one common denominator of all women's experience. I said before, I don't think that women have anything in common except fact of birth and the fact of death. Not all women have babies, not all women are heterosexual, not all women menstruate. Women have nothing, I think, universally true. So I'm not trying to define the essence of women's spirituality. I'm looking at different ways in which gender has made a difference for women. And it makes a tremendous difference in all of our lives, including men, and I think men have a tremendous amount to learn from women about how their gender has influenced them. But the way that gender makes a difference is very various. Okay, so today the focus is China Gallen's book, Longing for Darkness, Tara and the Black Madonna. It was written in 1990, and it's one of the books that I'm teaching you can get in paperback, so it's both inexpensive and rather current. It's a story about, it's a story about a pilgrimage, both literally, in that it takes her all over the globe, and spiritually, in terms of her search for female images of the divine, and in particular, black or dark images of the divine. I'm going to be basically through this 45-50 minutes reading some crucial paragraphs that give you a bit of the flavor of the book. I can't possibly do justice to any of these, 300 or 400 page works. I've just usually focused on one topic to organize it and hopefully, or I hope, have encouraged a few people to maybe read more. But I'm going to read a few paragraphs, comment on what I think is significant about them, and I invite your own comments or questions at any point. I don't want the questions all at the end, but when they hit you. So please feel free to just raise your hand and say, you know, geez, what strikes me about that passage is X. Those aren't interruptions. Those are part of a discussion that I hope we'll have. The book Longing for Darkness begins with Gallant talking about her upbringing and her past. She grew up as a Roman Catholic, and in the first passage I want to read, she talks about why she left the church. She had a problem with an abusive spouse, basically, and found solace in the wilderness, leading wilderness trips for other women in particular. The wilderness gave me solace, taught me, and filled up the empty places. Native American practices like the sweat lodge, the history of the order of the woman in the wilderness, my own experiences and those of other women all confirmed the spiritual value to be found in the natural world, pointed to a sacred landscape. Yet I did not live in the wilderness. As a single mother of three children and sporadic child support, family life was often chaotic and painful, dogged by a gnawing sense of failure, unable to get work, child care, and income to balance. I thought of packing up my children and retreating to a remote forest. But I was always stopped by considerations of how I would shelter, feed, clothe, and educate three children. I hardly knew how to grow a tomato, much less farm, fish, forage, or hunt. Underneath the surface, I was lost in the wilderness of the single-parent family. Raised a strict Roman Catholic, I married at 19. No one in my family had ever been divorced. But in less than 2 years, a Catholic priest had suggested that for my own safety and that of my children, I should file for a divorce and an annulment concurrently. Divorce would take place in civil court, but annulment had to be granted by the church. I had one child and was pregnant with my second when I left my marriage at 21. Annulments in the Catholic Church were decided upon in Rome at that time. You could remain in the church as a divorced person, but you could never remarry without an annulment. I elected to wait for the annulment to go through. I had a strong case and did not go out socially with men. After a year, it was suggested that I send a canon lawyer to Rome to expedite my case. Going through the normal channels meant that I might have to wait as long as 7 years. I made my first adult decision and left the church. I was unwilling to let a group of celibate men who had never had families have this kind of power over my life. With no money of my own and no enforceable order for child support, the suggestion that I fly a priest to Rome, however well-intended and practical, was a cruel joke. So you can see that her first adult decision, leaving the church, is very much shaped by what she sees as a patriarchal, authoritarian tradition that is completely crushing to a woman like herself. Scott?
It just struck me there that in the Roman Catholic tradition, that just I have heard that story, not that story, but the idea that you're hit with these pivotal points that you either have to leave or you don't have to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tremendously difficult to think mm-hmm. of how you would stay there in the midst of that. And I just think about that is one thing. But then there's the other part of it that the Roman Catholic Church is trying to do, which is what the Protestant Church is, the Lutheran Church is still trying mm-hmm. to do, which is still trying to maintain an ecclesiastical authority in a sense that you're mm-hmm. giving yourself over to something bigger. And that's a real mystery, how that balance is maintained. But it hit me that yeah. she had no choice. She literally had no choice.
Yeah.
If she was going to be, quote, an adult, or make an adult decision, I guess you'd say it.
Yeah. For me, it's a powerful passage because I just finished writing a book on the loss of faith. It's called Versions of Deconversion. And the basic idea is that often it's a rejection of a religious tradition that is both necessary for a person to maintain their integrity and in fact, often a decisive spiritual event that leads to something else, even though you can't see it at the time. But the rejection of one's childhood faith, I think, on some level, is I think necessary to become an adult and have a mature spirituality. You can't simply believe it, even if you come back to what you started out with.
Right.
There has to be that moment of independence and choosing a faith.
Because you haven't made the choice.
Yeah. She goes back several years later to the. She completely buries her spiritual life for a while. Goes back to the church later, and in this passage talks about how the male language just leaves her empty. She's saying mass. Now they're saying the words again. God gave man dominion. Our Father, His body, His blood. Glory be to the Father. Each time I hear God the Father, His, man, I feel smaller and smaller, as though something in the room is suffocating me. Communion comes, and I receive it in good faith, having made my first confession in 7 years. My legs are trembling as the priest puts the host on my tongue. My heart is racing. I can hardly breathe. As soon as Mass is over, I go to a side chapel where there's a statue of the Blessed Mother and kneel. Then the tears come, pouring out the frustration and sorrow, the welter of feelings brought up by having come home again, such a long way, only to find that I'm a stranger. And then notice how the figure of Mary gives her some comfort here. I'm consoled by the presence of the Virgin, the idea of the Blessed Mother, but she is so remote, impossibly good. This is the light, not the dark, but the light. Feminine, divine. She's so remote, impossibly good, inhumanly pure. I cannot reach her. There's a glass curtain, an invisible barrier between us. I don't know why I'm crying, only that I can't stop. I'm shaking when Father Peter leans over and touches my shoulder and asks what's wrong. I ache for the comfort of the Blessed Mother, but her perfection and purity leave me in despair. I'm filled with faults. I've built my life outside the church. There is no way back. I shake my head, not knowing what to say, how to tell him that the very language of the Mass fills me with grief. It says that I have no place here, keeps me outside, makes me other. In particular, she has a problem with alcohol. She's an alcoholic for a number of years. And I'll just share in briefly that one of her basic points is that it takes spirit to heal the spirits, addiction to the spirits. The only cure, I mean, a common theme for many people in 12-step programs and so forth, and her struggle with alcohol is important for a while in the book. But anyway, that notice that sense of her own imperfection, or what Christians would call sin, makes a light female divine, not meeting certain needs. So she turns out completely outside Christianity for a while and gets into Zen Buddhism and meditation. She's on the West Coast. And then while she's meditating in a Zen center, she hears about a tradition in Buddhism, a minority tradition, but an important one, in which there are female representations of the divine, and in particular, the goddess Tara, T-A-R-A, who is sometimes represented visually with very, very dark green or dark brown or black icons. This is the description in which she first hears about this tradition, and something in her just intuitively responds to that. One day at Green Gulch, a Zen center in California, someone told me about a female Buddha in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Her name was Tara. Despite the traditional Buddhist belief that a person could only reach enlightenment in a man's body, thousands and thousands of eons ago, in a time before this, this Tara had taken a vow to be enlightened only in a woman's body. And she had kept her vow. Hearing this fragment of Tara's story was electrifying. I was jolted out of the ongoing background frustration of being a woman trying to practice in traditional organized religions. Women could not become priests in the Catholic Church. And though the notion was rejected at Zen Center, there was the discomforting tradition within Buddhism in general that women could not reach enlightenment. This tradition was downplayed as Buddhism came to the West, yet the belief had its effect, no matter what was said now. There were only a handful of women teachers in the entire country at the time. Standing on the deck at Green Gulch, hearing about the Buddha Tara that morning after a lecture, galvanized me. The idea that a woman so long ago had rejected this notion, had vowed that she would become enlightened in a female body, and had done so, inspired me to begin a search for her that would send me off halfway around the world. A woman had said, enough. Having a woman's body is good enough. A woman's body can carry one across the river of suffering. It can transform the world of suffering, samsara, into the world of peace, nirvana. It can show that there is nothing to cross, no other side. End of quote. Notice how she discovers first in Buddhism, as she will discover later in Christianity, that while the religion is officially very patriarchal and dominated by males and authoritarian, there are minority traditions within Buddhism, as she will discover within Christianity, which affirm women. She has to find that first outside Christianity before she can, as we'll see, realize it within Christianity. She goes on pilgrimages to Nepal and ends up meeting the Dalai Lama and does a lot. There's a lot of stuff in here about Buddhism. I'm going to kind of downplay that part and focus primarily on her wrestling with the West and with Christian tradition, because I suspect it will ring more bells with those of us here. After a lot of searching in the East, she starts to notice here and there in the West that there are called the minority traditions in which the divine is represented with female imagery. For example, the Gnostic traditions that Elaine Pagels has studied, in which, you know, there are all these other gospels besides the four that made it in the New Testament, in which the divine is often symbolized in as wisdom, as Sophia, as mother. The Holy Spirit is often seen as feminine. There's that whole tradition in the West which was suppressed, in which the divine was represented using female imagery. She starts to see that later in Western history, there are little ways in which in which God is not only represented as female, but there are these images of black Madonnas that pop up. Here's a brief quote in which she just suggests some of the places she found these. The black Madonna has had a widespread effect on Western culture, whether we have known about her or not. She is the symbol of the Polish nation. She was Goethe's inspiration for the eternal feminine in Faust. Saint Ignatius Loyola gave his sword to the black Madonna of Montserrat in Spain, became a priest, and founded the Jesuit order. Ephesus, the ancient center for the worship of the great goddess Artemis, Diana, was the same place that Mary was declared Theotokos, the mother of God, by the early Christians in the year 431, at the Third Ecumenical Council, amidst all manner of controversy and celebrations, torchlight processions through the streets, cheering and shouting of praise to the Mother of God. And she elaborates on this and hypothesizes that Christianity's whole attitude to Mary picks up on some much more ancient traditions in the ancient world, gives them new names, but that ancient hunger of women and men for a feminine representation of the divine gets a kind of transformed echo in Christianity. I'm going to skip quite a bit of the book to a pilgrimage she makes to Switzerland, where she, this is tough to summarize briefly, but she realizes that in alchemy, which, you know, to modern Westerners often seems like just a kind of a bizarre, superstitious, pagan, you know, like reading astrology in the papers or something today. Alchemy was in some ways a spiritual study, not simply a form of chemistry, but in symbolic form, a study of the transformation of the self and of the soul. And the different elements, the different rocks, often symbolize different parts of the human psyche or soul. Darkness was part of that process, and the alchemical process had to use, you know, you couldn't get gold, you couldn't get the perfect whole soul without incorporating into it elements of darkness. She goes to a monastery called, I don't know if they're pronounced, my German's not too hot, Einsiedeln, anybody know this place in Switzerland? Where, which is a very important shrine in Switzerland, where a monk named Meinrad in the 9th century retired to the forest, began to live with ravens, a dark bird, and at this place today there is a black Madonna. Maybe I can find a quick picture of it here to hold up for those of you here. Here's a quick visual picture of the Black Madonna of Einsiedeln in Switzerland. And she goes to this place and sees this Madonna. Kind of tiny and black and white of color. Well, black ought to be a color. Black is an important color here. And in making this pilgrimage, let me cut to her summary of what for her darkness means and why it's important. The construction of the chapel of the Black Madonna within the larger church of the monastery at Einsiedeln, directly over Meinrad's cell and place of death, takes on a larger resonance and points not only to an event, but to the alchemical process itself. The Black Madonna of Einsiedeln grew out of Meinrad's decision to live with the ravens, to pursue a deeper meaning in life, to go the way of the Nigredo, the Finster Wall, and sorry, I don't have time to explain all these words, to inhabit his own dark places. To say that one is longing for darkness is to say that one longs for transformation, for a darkness that brings balance, wholeness, integration, wisdom, insight, I now realize. For so long, I didn't know what I meant when I said that, when I felt it, a longing for darkness. I remember standing in front of that statue of Kali in India and thinking of this Madonna in Switzerland. Now I find not only the Madonna, but the beginning of words to name that longing and desire. Late one night over coffee, when I said that I was longing for darkness, a friend said, "Watch out! It's dangerous to say that. You don't know what you're calling to yourself." And this, I think, is probably part of all of our reactions to this book, and it's part of my own also, that we've been so, darkness is evil in our culture, in the cultural imagination. Light is good. In longing for darkness, are we longing for evil? I think that kind of moral scruple is one of the chief issues that she's trying to deal with in this book. And in response to that friend's suggestion that this whole pilgrimage is a kind of a dangerous thing, she says, "The association of the word darkness with something negative, with evil, is precisely the problem I'm naming. That kind of association is one of the cornerstones of racism." Mm-hmm. Racism is evil, not darkness. Mm-hmm. there's a redeeming darkness, and this is what I seek. Seeing the Madonna of Einsiedeln proved to me that the longing for darkness is a deeply felt human need that cuts across, goes beyond, and at the same time includes issues of ethnicity. This is a multivalent darkness. This is the darkness of ancient wisdom, of people of color. I mean, why do black people have soul in American culture today? I mean, that's interesting that that word should be chosen for what we, on some level, lack. What I feel like, you know, what I feel that was the power of gospel music or Martin Luther King or any number of other examples, Malcolm X. The darkness of people of color, of space, of the womb, of the earth, of the unknown, of sorrow, of the imagination, the darkness of death, of the human heart, of the unconscious, of the darkness beyond light, of matter, of the descent, of the body, of the shadow of the Most High. Of all the dualisms of Western thought, darkness is a symbol of all that we've said that we have to flee in order to get to the spirit, the light, the male, the white, the bright, the culturally validated. Like light, darkness has a wide range of symbolic meanings. The color black can signify the stage just before enlightenment in Tibetan Buddhism. Imminence, space, burning, the final stage of the soul's journey to beatitude in a Sufi tradition. Black can symbolize wisdom, fertility in old Europe, purity in a Turkish tradition, mourning in the West, and the first step in the medieval alchemical process. Darkness, blackness can symbolize all those things. Reaction so far? Things that struck you? Problems you have?
It sounds like the healing that comes from going within us and naming those things which we fear.
Mm-hmm.
We fear darkness. We fear not being able to see. We fear blindness.
Mm-hmm.
We fear anything that has anything to do with that. We fear our more somber natures. We're supposed to be laughing all the time. We fear grief. We fear loss. We fear everything that without it, the life would not be the wonderful roller coaster that it is.
Mm-hmm.
You can't enjoy a roller coaster unless you have the dips. A roller coaster with just highs on it is not a roller coaster. I heard it said on a show, this is not an analogy. I mean, but it was a good analogy. It was Sisters, by the way. Not Sisters, it was from a movie, Parenthood.
Parenthood.
From the grandmas. Right. And that analogy struck with me. Because we can't enjoy a roller coaster without the dips. And to own and to heal our inner self, we must retreat into darkness. We must retreat away from the cacophony of all light. Sometimes, you know, we can't even think if there's too much energy, too much screaming and lights and action and all. The darkness of meditation. And to really hear the heartbeat of the soul and all that. I mean, That to me is what she seems to be getting at. And a lot of us are ill in this society because we like to deny that. We're supposed to suppress all that.
Mm-hmm.
And to own it and to name it and to say that's part of me and that's okay too,
mm-hmm.
is part of what Christ let us own in our own darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Forgiveness is not a once every 7 day event. It's a process. We are in the process of constantly being forgiven, and therefore we're in the process of always having to search out those places, and sometimes they cherished moments, which gives us breadth and depth. It gives us some meaning to life. Life without death is, where's the meaning to that life? How can you cherish life that is never ending in a sense? You know, you cherish it that much because of its limitations. You cherish those moments. So that, you know, that searching out is what I see.
We do need these reminders said well, too. I mean, I've thought about this, our stereotypes of light and dark, but I haven't thought of it with that kind of substance and integrity. I know we've been talking with the kids about happiness and sadness or happiness and depression. I've said to them, you know, if you have a really happy day and you're feeling great, you don't go around all day saying, oh my gosh, why am I so happy? But if you're sad, you know, somebody will try to get you out of it or say that, you know, oh, why am I so sad? And you kind of don't let it happen. It's exactly what Steve was saying. And you bring this negative connotation to that state, which may or may might not need to be there. I really like, I'd like that, you know, a couple of those paragraphs that I just looked at once a week to remind me.
Scott?
I was thinking along those lines. We're just talking about, there's a great fear, I think, in Christianity of paganism and witchery, for example, which is, from its most generic sense, has to do with earth-type religions.
Yeah.
You think of the earth as the soil is dark. It implies a great deal of sort of things that in Christianity have been identified specifically as breaches of faith. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the pagans traditionally have been paganism has been a real problem in Christianity historically. So that's earth, that's the darkness, and I think that's, from a spiritual level, there's a real historical fear that we have, that if we get into that arena at all, we are treading with the infidels, you know, in that sense, the those who do not believe polytheism, for example, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it's the same kind of thing, but from a slightly different dimension. Because I find that fear in myself a lot. And I poke around and trying to come to grips with what that means. How do you integrate earth religions and a love of the earth and all that without, and at the same time, rejecting the great traditions that have preceded, which have not been, have been earth-centered.
I thought about the fact that this took place in Switzerland, and I was thinking of Jung in psychology, which did, you'll know, a fourth of his works are in alchemy, and it is still considered bizarre. And I also thought of the concept of the shadow in Jungian psychology and therapy, which is the integration of your the very thing that you're afraid of, the darkness. But it's only one step. And my other reaction was to her reaction of the pre-suggestion that she send a lawyer to Italy, and your statement that, you know, they were trying to hold on to something. My thought was, all they're trying to hold on is their power. I mean, I was just I just rageful almost at that suggestion, because it was so out of any kind of understanding of what she was going through, and so utterly ridiculous,
You really understand why someone would just reject this whole tradition.
I don't know why she ever went back. Just so insulting. And I'm sure you believe it passionately, and I'm sure they are trying to hold on to something, but nothing that I could appreciate. You know, to me, it just so clearly would seem like they're trying to hold on to their own power.
The Jungian comment you made was interesting too, and I thought of it when Steve was talking earlier, in terms of when we can't accept that we have those dark elements as part of us, or those down times, or whatever they are, evil in ourselves. What do? We project them outwards on others, and you know, the gay person, the woman, the black, you know, any number of examples you could give become the embodiment of evil, and it's all out there, and we're or pagan religions, you know, Christianity is the truth, the only truth, and there's no truth in any other. When we can't see any ambiguity of light and dark within ourselves, we can't see it in others, and there's a clear ethical dimension of this in terms of our, you know, racism, environmentalism, environmental problems, etc. So, and I think Galen is probably influenced somewhat by Jung's ideas on this whole thing. And to me, I mean, I think that's one reason this book speaks to me, is that it correlates with some of my other ideas about the need to be, you know, not perfect people, but whole people. Although I guess I would say that Christianity at its best has the same insight, and forgiveness, as Steve said, has something to do with that. So I would quarrel with some of her characterizations of Christianity. But let me go on and read another passage in which she talks about Mary. And, you know, Protestants often feel kind of smug and superior to Catholics. You know, here are those Catholics worshiping Mary, right? You know, they're all idolaters and only we really worship God. Well, that seems like rather a caricature. And in many ways, Protestants are impoverished by comparison, at least in terms of this, the possibility of representing God, the Almighty, the Ultimate, the Incomprehensible, in female as well as male language. So here's a passage in which Galen argues that that Mary is a figure who should be significant not only for Catholics, but for all Christians. And, you know, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about Mary, but there's some truth in this that it rings some bells in myself. The Church of Rome insists that Mary can only intercede with God, that she's only a petitioner on behalf of the faithful. In and of herself, Mary can do nothing. Only her son or his father has any power. But whether it's condoned or not, the worship of Mary is practiced by many people, acknowledging a reality in her much greater than is admitted by the institutional church. Rome claims that Mary can only be venerated, not adored. She can have a special veneration more than the saints, but she cannot have adoration. Yet the dogma of the church and the religious practices of the faithful have often been in unspoken conflict. The actual practices and understanding of the faithful are sometimes quite different from the formal teachings of the clergy. The worship of Mary is evidence of this phenomenon. But Mary does not belong just to certain belief systems. She belongs to everyone who longs for a richer, more vital conception of a power greater than ourselves, which some choose to call God. She presents a challenge and an opportunity for anyone who talks about the re-emerging goddess or a goddess religion, and yet for many she is too bound up with Rome. I long to liberate Mary from the Catholic Church. We all need her. We all need her. Perhaps then we can consider what it means to have the presence of God the Mother in our midst today. You know, powerful passage, I think. And, you know, where is God the Mother in Protestant Christianity today? For me, the Holy Spirit is an important concept here, but it's, you know, I haven't got all the details worked out. I don't think anybody does. It's a, yeah, Ruth.
Well, one of the things that has so struck me in doing some study of goddess religions and cultures is that, you know, for possibly close to 25,000 years, the earliest sanctuaries were caves. Mm-hmm. And the cave was chosen as the place of sanctuary because it was the physical symbol. I mean, it was a symbol of the womb. And it's staggering to me to realize that the earliest sanctuaries, the earliest places of worship, the earliest places of honoring the sacred were within the womb of the goddess and within the womb of Mother Earth. And that is such a startling and antithetical image to the Gothic cathedrals that soar sky high, mm-hmm. that are kind of a paean to more male metaphors for God as transcendent and other, outer, upper. I've thought about that, about how different it would be for women if we saw our bodies as expressions of, as sanctuaries of the sacred. And the problem that I have with Mary, as the Catholic Church has mediated Mary to sure. us, is that the Catholic Church has de-sexed Mary with the doctrine of the virgin birth and Immaculate Conception and all of that. We have lost the immanence of woman's blood, woman's birth, woman's life-giving powers, the body of woman as sacred, and Mary has become, neutered.
Yeah.
She's become de-sexed, disembodied, and so it's. I think that Mary could be a point of entry for Christians into the feminine of the sacred, if that had not happened.
Mm-hmm. But it's too late.
Yeah, and that problem that I have then with the Holy Spirit as being the expression of the feminine in the Trinity is that the Holy Spirit, in the imaginations of most people, is very, very disembodied.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a problem. To find a way to embody the female in Christianity is a problem that I have yet to resolve.
Yeah.
And so that then means that for males, who look into a mirror and see their reflection, that image can be a window to God. But for women who look into the mirror and see their reflection, we see a wall. And so I don't. This is. These are. I mean, I'm interested in how she ends up resolving her break with the Christian tradition and her reconciliation with it, or her at least reconnection with it, because I don't think that. I don't think that I have that reconciliation myself.
Yeah.
And in my work with lesbian and gay people, the irony is that a lot of our ministry is spent assisting gay men to reconcile with the church and assisting lesbians to leave it.
That's interesting.
And because there are so many lesbians who really have given up on any kind of real transformation in the tradition that can reclaim women's bodies as expressions of the sacred.
Ruth, one of the things I've done for myself, and it's kind of simple-minded probably, but it has to do with the concept of being made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, in the Genesis story, it's in God we
right.
will create,
right.
in our image.
Right.
And when what I've done is just say, this is trying to tell me more about the image of God than about me. And we have always turned it around. We
right.
used God to tell us about us.
Right.
And we're back to this, the maleness of God image needing really to be deluded, I think, because that's where we have deluded ourselves.
Yeah, I think that there's certainly evidence of time periods that were more vital in their appreciation of the feminine as part of the sacred. And
I think it was leading the birth religions that began this whole process for women, because those were women-centered religions. And as Christianity reacted against, the cult.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing this. Everyone who's talked, I also don't have this worked. I'm not saying Christianity has the answer. I really like the word longing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Longing for darkness. And I've heard several people also talk about longing for, I don't know if Mary is quite the right word, but longing for a feminine embodiment of the divine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I'm at too.
Mm-hmm.
Men, I think men long mm-hmm. some men on some level, maybe all men at the deepest level, mm-hmm. long for that. And that's where I'm at. I don't have the explanation of what's going to resolve that. Mm-hmm. But that hunger in me, that desire in me, that longing in me, I think is God calling to me. Mm-hmm. Deep calls to deep, and my hunger for the feminine mm-hmm. is one way that God is mm-hmm. calling to me now, I think. Mm-hmm. So sometimes just to stay with the longing mm-hmm. and not try to resolve it or explain it or say Christianity has the answers or it doesn't, but just to stay with the longing and the hunger and articulate that is where mm-hmm. the spirit is alive. That's at least that's my view. Yeah.
I just want to say that God said that he isn't man nor woman, and he isn't mm-hmm. any color or creed or anything. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of when people say in the Bible, they keep on saying he and our Father, mm-hmm. but he said himself that he isn't one gender.
That God isn't one gender. Mm-hmm.
But we don't have a language hardly to say that. You know, even as you're talking about
it. I mean, it's kind of hard to say it. People portray him as a man because men are portrayed as masculine, and mm-hmm. and our Father, he says, you know, I will protect you, and
yeah.
so they naturally assume that he would be a man, but he doesn't have, he's just there.
The thing that strikes me from the Jesus persona is we always assume that Jesus was sent to the earth because a man is what needed to come to the earth. I always am struck by the phrase that the foolishness of God is, you know, or the wisdom of humans is foolishness to God and vice versa. My sense is that God had a couple choices. If God sent a woman to the earth, would a woman who was giving, self-sacrificial, etc., would have been viewed as different? With that persona, a giving woman, at that time, who sacrificed herself for others, would that have been an unusual picture?
It's redundant.
That's what I'm wondering. Now I'm wondering
all
whether
of them do that?
Jesus came
what's the big deal?
To straighten up the image of man. Because women had, remember, the woman was the first to be told. Woman gave birth to... So women had a lot to go with, and men needed to be straightened out to help women along. I'm wondering whether the Jesus story is misinterpreted, that Jesus is what we would view as foolishness. God said, I feel closer to women right now, and therefore I need to send a man, because this man would be viewed as different from other men and needs to bring men to an understanding. Women will come to this place. And I look at the Nag Hammadi, and I look at the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, and that whole group, and I say, men are very threatened with the idea that Jesus is the foolishness of God. That Jesus is the foolishness of God, or the wisdom of God, and the foolishness of man, and I mean man in this case. That men are foolish enough to think that they're so important, that Jesus has to be pivotal. As a man. But perhaps God said, men, you have to be different in this way. And, you know, I don't think the gospel is ever, and yet that phrase is in the Bible. You know, the phrase is in the Bible. And I see this, and yet men have jumped on it and hold up the banner and says, well,
where is it? My Allison has been teaching me, so I don't know who I'm quoting here, but she's been reading a lot, and she has this understanding that probably Jesus was a gay man. And that his most beloved John, which you can document in several different verses, may or may not shed some light on some understanding. But I mean, if we are in a patriarchal culture for many generations, this is not something you would want to look at.
This is a great conversation. Let me in the last 10 minutes, though, come back to the book, because there are a couple other dimensions of meaning here that I haven't even begun to talk about that I want to be sure you don't miss. One is that the symbols of the Black Madonna often have a political meaning. and that spirituality and politics are connected in this symbol. China Galen goes on a pilgrimage to Poland, and apparently every year in Poland there is an enormous pilgrimage, and here's a picture of it. I mean, millions of people marching to the patron saint of Poland, who is a Black Madonna. The Black Madonna of, I think it's pronounced Szestakowa. Is that how it's pronounced?
I don't know, but I know of the phenomenon.
Yeah. This is in 1987, and it's before, it's while the Union Solidarity is still outlawed. And the Black Madonna of this monastery in Poland is also the patron of the Solidarity movement. And since Solidarity is banned and can have no public rallies, this religious pilgrimage to this shrine becomes the occasion for Solidarity to show that it exists, to wave its banners. There's an interesting picture of Czech Valesa, is that how it's pronounced? I can't, I was...
Lech Valesa.
My knowledge of the news fades very rapidly. Anyway, there's a picture of him in here wearing a little picture of the Black Madonna. Mm-hmm. And so this symbol of, I mean, the symbol of the Black Madonna becomes a symbol of Polish, not exactly nationalism, but resistance. Resistance to oppressive power. And the Black Madonna thus comes to have a very powerful signature. She goes on this long pilgrimage and has an extremely, I guess I can't take the time to read it, but just a very powerful experience of pilgrimage in which she makes a confession to a Catholic priest and really feels, again, part of not exactly the church, but an enormous community of fellow Christians. And she can't speak Polish. And it's, you know, if you've ever been in a crowd of hundreds of thousands of people, not able to speak, alone, not able to speak their language, it can be very terrifying. And she gets lost and is physically exhausted and just kind of almost breaks down, but just trusts in this enormous swell of humanity who share her veneration of this Black Madonna. So that's a powerful experience that I can't really do justice to. If I had longer, I'd read a very lyrical passage about that sense of belonging to a community, and yet the community doesn't have a name. It's not the Polish Catholic Church exactly. It's not Solidarity. It's something vaguer, and yet it's real. Later towards the end of the book, she hears about Black Madonnas in the Hispanic population in the United States, and I don't know if in Brazil there are mm-hmm. Black Madonnas, but she hears about one in Texas, and finds out that in fact there is a Black Madonna who is a kind of patron for migrant workers. This is in the late 80s when the sanctuary movement is a very controversial issue, and there are thousands and thousands of migrant workers just sitting. It's almost like a deportation camp. I don't know if anybody here is from Texas, probably knows a lot more about this than I do. But it's really rather like the Japanese in concentration camps in the 1940s. There are just lots and lots of migrant workers locked up. So she goes and finds out that that there are Black Madonnas who are very, very important religious symbols for these migrant workers. While she's there, she also starts meeting Salvadorans and Guatemalans and people from Central America who have fled Central America, and discovers a fascinating poster that I'll show you called The Madonna for El Salvador, Madre de los, somebody who speaks Spanish pronounces, Desaparecidos, the mother of the disappeared. And I'll read you a quick description of this, and then I'll show you the picture. Painted in the traditional Byzantine or Greek icon style against the non-traditional backdrop of a Central American jungle, The image of this dark brown-skinned Mary was stunning. But when I noticed the white handprint smudged in the lower left-hand corner of the painting, I was brought up short and felt a visceral punch. The white hand, one of the death squads in El Salvador. So here's a picture of the Black Madonna and the hand of the death squad. You know, when they would take somebody away, they would leave this white hand.
It was called something of the disappeared?
Yeah, the mother of the disappeared.
Oh, wow.
There's a whole group called it the mothers of the
disappeared. Is that right?
That's the group in Argentina.
The mothers of the...
Yes, the mothers of the disappeared.
They were individuals, and they were political. They were as an organized group.
Sure. Well, this Black Madonna is their symbol, and Galland realizes that there's a whole another dimension of meaning here. Let me just briefly read this, because I just think it's a very powerful passage. I began to imagine Mary differently. I imagined Mary as a fierce mother one morning in my prayers and meditation, not the passive, desexualized, kind of floating in the clouds image that Ruth was talking about, but something much more fierce. And the image of Tara, also in Buddhism, is like that. Tara can devour you, can devour her enemies, eat them up. I imagine Mary protecting Christ. The Mary I saw stepped in front of his tormentors. She did not stand passively. I'm reading the wrong passage. Okay. The Madonna with the white hand of the death squad on her icon. She too was marked in solidarity with the disappeared. Suddenly it hit. This was the Madonna I'd come to see. Everything I'd not understood began to fit. There's a point at which the spiritual and the political intersect. The icon of the Madre de los Desaparecidos exploded out of that junction. I stared at the image for a long time before going back to my room to sleep. It occurred to me that there's something false about the way Mary was so often depicted as a passive sufferer. I no longer believe that. Mary is not passive. The image that we've been shown has truth in it, but it's a limited truth. I derived great comfort in the fact that Mary was an earthly mother, that she went through a pregnancy as a teenage mother, that she had known homelessness, that she had borne at least one child. She had witnessed that child's suffering and death. She knew the depths of a mother's sorrow. But Mary's passivity may be all that we've allowed ourselves to see. But you know, there are hints in the Bible why would homeless people maybe relate to Mary? Why would pregnant mothers whose father was, the father for whose children was questionable, relate to the figure of Mary? These are all elements of Mary that are there in the Bible. Her passivity may be all that we've allowed ourselves to see, a woman rising up against authority, a woman strong and fearless, a ferocious woman, an independent woman, a heroic woman, a physically courageous woman. To have seen Mary this way would not serve the social order. This is a Mary we have not seen in the West. This is Mary that we need now. A fierce Mary, a terrific Mary, a fearsome Mary, a protectress who does not allow her children to be hunted, tortured, murdered, and devoured. Let's see, how do I sum this up? Well, let me read one more quote. One more final quote before I let you go or let you respond. The meaning of blackness now changes when she sees Mary associated with this suffering. Struck by the Madonna in Texas, like a meteorite falling out of the sky, I didn't see her coming. I didn't see that following Tara would take me back through Mary, would knock me off a solitary path into the heat and controversy of community. The Madonna de los Lagos, de la Guadalupe, de los Desaparecidos, these three Madonnas in Hispanic traditions, let the world in, burned. Mary is dark from entering lives on fire. The Indo-European root of the word black meant gleaming. Gleaming, black from